This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk with expert Al McCoy, author of A Question of Torture, about the recent release of the CIA's Office of Inspector General report. We'll learn about the Employee Free Choice Act, a proposed bill that would speed up the process for employees to form a union. Joining us will be Abby Scheer from The Public Eye. Stay with us. We've talked about this before on Law and Disorder, but we have an update on the use of red light and speed enforcement cameras. The state of Florida now is experiencing a spate of lawsuits involving the cameras and the steep fines that they bring. Marketed as a safety device, these cameras are clearly great moneymakers. In a typical system in Florida, for example, the vendor receives a cut ranging from $17 to $47 per ticket. The cities keep the rest. In some cities, the tickets cost $125 apiece. And in many other jurisdictions, the fines escalate after repeat offenses. The lawsuits focus on one central argument. Traffic laws must be uniform across the state, and city-by-city camera laws violate that principle. All the lawsuits also raise due process concerns, which we've discussed before. The cameras have been challenged in other states as well. In 2007, the Minnesota Supreme Court unanimously ruled against the Minneapolis Red Light Camera Program, finding, along with the lines of the Florida arguments, that the cameras violated state law that required uniformity in traffic laws. Just this past March, a Maryland judge allowed a speed camera class action lawsuit to proceed. If successful, the lawsuit could force some or all of the tickets issued under the illegal contract to be refunded. It would also set an important precedent that will decide whether or not local governments can freely violate the law in order to maximize ticket revenue. In other jurisdictions, citizen initiative programs to stop photo enforcement are meeting with often hostile tactics from local officials. In College Station, Texas, for example, one resident in charge of gathering petition signatures claims that city officials tried to sabotage the ballot initiative by trying to circumvent a public vote on the future of the cameras. It's worth noting that in all cases where such measures have been put on the ballot, photo enforcement has actually never survived. In 2009, 86% of a Louisiana city rejected speed cameras. Residents in Cincinnati, Ohio, did the same. 76% of Steubenville, Ohio voters rejected photo radar in 2006. And in 1997, Anchorage, Alaska voters banned cameras even after the local authorities had removed them. Last month marked the release of the CIA's Office of Inspector General report investigating the use of, quote, enhanced interrogation techniques against detainees. The nearly 50% redacted report focused on incidents which exceeded the torture guidelines written in the Office of Legal Counsel torture memos. In the report, waterboarding a detainee 183 times was noted with only a concern, and highlighted abuses include faking the execution of a detainee by, quote, contractors without training and pointing an unloaded gun to a prisoner's head. This recently released report could have helped prosecute torture architects such as John Yu and other Office of Legal Counsel attorneys who violated their professional ethical duties when they authored the memos claiming the administration's proposed torture techniques were lawful. Back with us today to discuss a report is author Al McCoy, who has published several books, including A Question of Torture. Al, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Hi, Heidi. Glad to be back.
What types of abuses against detainees are detailed in the recent report that the public may not have been aware of until this point in time?
First of all, I think the chronology is important. The report is an investigative report into excesses. It's not a thorough review of the entire CIA interrogation program as it operated in the aftermath of September 11th, 2001. It's focusing on what went wrong, the crimes, the possible crimes. And you need to be clear about that. And what the CIA Inspector General found through what looks like, you know, within the limits of the agency, a fairly good investigation, was there was a period ranging for about 12 to 18 months when the alternative methods were ordered and authorized by President Bush, particularly what came to be known as EITs, Enhanced Interrogation Techniques. You have to understand, first of all, the significance of what President Bush did. For the first time in the history of the CIA, they were authorized to operate their own prisons, the so-called eight black sites that operated from Thailand to Poland or Lithuania. And also there was a sort of a satellite site in Guantanamo Bay complex. For the previous 50 years that the CIA had been involved in various ways in interrogation and in torture, they'd always been either training usually third world military or working with allied military like allied intelligence agencies like the British. So in a sense, they've been outsourcing, training Honduran military in the 1980s, dropping in on Honduran military prisons to supervise or to cream off the intelligence gained by these torturous methods. But they never ran their own prisons. And also, the CIA guys never actually in the past, with a few exceptions we don't know very much about, they never actually dirtied their own hands or bloodied their own hands with, slapping or wall slamming and waterboarding. So this was different. The CIA, for the first time, was doing it itself rather than developing techniques through research and training others on how to do it for them. They weren't outsourcing. Now, okay, so what happened inside these black sites? A kind of little shop of horrors inside these sites. They opened up the sites. They began collecting detainees before they had clear guidelines and before they had the procedures of supervision. And so what they did is they took the gloves off and they told the CIA guys, the gloves are off, do what you need to do. And as often happens with torture, because it's so seductive, it's so powerfully erotic in its subtle appeal to the human mind, a process about which we know very little, that they went too far. They started doing things, the techniques got excessive, the infliction of cold was medically unsafe. People were stripped naked on cold concrete floors in uninsulated rooms. They cocked guns. They engaged in mock executions. Through an Arabic interpreter, there was an incident where they implied that female relatives would be brought in and sexually molested, raped before the victim. With Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, there was a direct death threat. Well, under U.S. law, Section 2340 of the Federal Code, and the Enhanced War Crimes Act of 1997, psychological torture is basically legalized, and there are only four things you cannot do under U.S. law. There are only four acts of a psychological nature within aggressive interrogation that constitute crimes. And one of them is threats, death threats, and the other is death threats against a third party. If you don't talk, I'm going to kill somebody near and dear to you. Well, they did that. They actually, through the mock executions and through direct statements, they violated U.S. law. And that's why the Inspector General investigated. So that's one of the most important findings, is that there was this year-long or 18-month period in which these places were horror shows, and in which the law, the U.S. law, which is very broad and very indulgent on psychological interrogation, has almost no restrictions, that these laws were broken. And that means that the U.S. Attorney General, the Bush Justice Department, should have prosecuted back then. But we also find that report that on the second anniversary of 9/11, September 11, 2003, the Bush Justice Department said, no crime, you got a free pass. Well, now that that's being reviewed, it looks like crimes were clearly committed and investigation, if not prosecution, is in order.
Attorney General Holder was said to have been personally disgusted by what has taken place, which led to his appointing John Durham to the investigation. As special prosecutor, what if anything, do you think will come out of this investigation?
One of the crimes described in that report that in July, I think it was June or July 2003, sort of the tail end of this 12 to 18-month period of uncontrolled, illegal, what the CIA called inhumane interrogation. When the CIA Inspector General said that they used the word inhumane interrogation. At the end of this period, a CIA contract operative in a base in Afghanistan, in the course of interrogation, beat and kicked a detainee to death. And that guy, his name is David Passaro, was ultimately prosecuted and sentenced to 8 years in prison. So that there was one prosecution. And in fact, David Passaro, within the CIA hierarchy, is the kind of the equivalent of those very low-ranking soldiers at Abu Ghraib, like Private Lindy England. He's about the equivalent of that. So what I expect is going to happen is that, you know, there might be another equivalent of a David Passaro, the guy that revved the drill or cocked the gun or made the implied threat of death or of rape of a female relative, that one of those hapless field agents that went over the top will be prosecuted. And we're likely to have a repetition of what we did, what the military did. We know that the military chain of command, Donald Rumsfeld, authorized extraordinary techniques. And as his directions went down through the chain of command, it got all the way down to Abu Ghraib prison, where those soldiers were actually complying with those directives. The directives were illegal. The person that should have been prosecuted or should be prosecuted is Donald Rumsfeld. If you're going to prosecute Lindy England, you should be prosecuting the person that gave those orders at the top of the chain of command. You should be prosecuting Ricardo Sanchez, the lieutenant general who's in command of U.S. forces in Iraq, who gave explicit orders for techniques that were tantamount to torture. Okay, so we're likely to see a repetition of this process, scapegoating. In this case, instead of being bad apples in military parlance, we're going to have rogue agents. So it's going to be another David Passaro-like figure down at the bottom who's going to get prosecuted. And we are not going to, in fact, engage in it looks like at this point, a thorough and searching review of what actually happened during the Bush years with interrogation, whether these methods were in fact effective, whether they actually corrupted the intelligence process by torturing spurious information, which the Bush-Cheney administration used to advance their case for the weapons of mass destruction by Saddam Hussein and the invasion of Iraq. All the excesses of this period, we're not going to do that.
We've talked a bit on this show about the fact that perhaps the very concept of torture, as abhorrent as this is, over the last few years, has become almost commonplace in our society. You know, it's shown on TV programs now. And the very fact that we aren't prosecuting Bush and Cheney and those who are ultimately were responsible, were the architects of this. Can you explain why there doesn't seem to be the kind of outrage that we saw after the initial publication of the photos of Abu Ghraib, for example?
Sure. First of all, you have to understand that that was probably, that expose of Abu Ghraib was the fifth time since 1970, the fifth time in the 50 years that the CIA has been engaged in training and propagation of torture techniques, that we've had a major scandal. The first occurred over the Phoenix program in Vietnam in 1970. We've been here before. Actually, the outrage over Abu Ghraib was far stronger than the revelations about the extraordinarily brutal and murderous torture techniques used in South Vietnam and the techniques used in Central America during the 1980s. And the reason is simply the graphic power of the photos. That's why the Obama administration has been willing to release this CIA Inspector General report, been willing to release those rather dry, desiccated Justice Department memos, which if you read the footnotes, have actually got lots of good information, because they don't have any kind of impact. But the photos stir up deep and powerful emotions, and so the Obama administration is not releasing those photos, and the CIA destroyed, I think, 94 videotapes. So the emotion was stirred by the photos. And if you actually, if the American public had a chance to look at the rest of the Abu Ghraib photos, there's 1,600 of them collected from the Army Criminal Investigation Command, and we've probably only seen so far in public 24 of them. Every journalist who works on this story has got copies of them. You probably have them too. They're circulating everywhere except on public media, and they go on and on and on. They're horrible. They're repulsive. If these were out there, you know, beyond the few we've seen, the anger would be extreme. The demand for reform would be relentless. So it's the power of the photos, and thus the destruction of the graphic images, the visual images, and their suppression. Okay, so that's a key factor. We haven't seen the photos, and now the photos are fading from memory. The rage is dissipating. The second factor in this, I think, is also the processes of impunity. Whether you're talking about the United Kingdom for the crimes in Belfast, or France for the crimes in Algeria, Indonesia, the Philippines, Argentina, South Africa, the processes of impunity are pretty much the same around the world. The process goes like this, okay? And this is assuming that the state is dealing with this on its own terms. We're not talking about invasion and some kind of tribunal, okay? Or we're not talking about the change of regime, as it happened in Greece, and then a tribunal, the famous torture trials in Greece in the 1970s. This is assuming continuity of government. So what happens in a case where you've got continuity of government, and even sometimes we have a change of regime, is the following. First of all, blame the bad apples. Well, we did that. Lindy England goes to jail. Donald Rumsfeld has a comfortable retirement on the Maryland shore and has published his memoirs and probably makes several million dollars. The next stage is, you know, it was necessary for our security. And this is the argument that Dick Cheney is making over and over again. He just made it last Sunday on the Sunday morning talk shows. He's demanding that we release the memos, which have now been two of them released, that show the efficacy of torture. In other words, his argument is, so what if we tortured? It made us safe. The third stage in impunity, the one that everybody ultimately comes to, is, well, we may have done this in the past. Yes, there may have been crimes, but we need to pull together and move forward to protect ourselves and develop our nation. And that's the position taken by President Obama. Every nation that adopts torture as state practice seems to go through a parallel process. And we've very quickly gone through all three stages. We're now at stage three.
One of the problems that we know about is that evidence or testimony elicited from torture is not reliable. I'm surprised that Obama isn't making that distinction in terms of using the national security argument.
The evidence is unreliable, and the techniques that the United States was using, which date back to the 1950s, when the CIA developed its interrogation techniques, it not only did its own research and discovered, very importantly, the whole phenomenon of sensory deprivation, which remains central to U.S. interrogation doctrine even today, they also studied communist techniques. From the communists, they got the idea of the stress position, enforced standing. The CIA had two very distinguished cognitive scientists at Cornell University Medical Center in New York City under contract throughout the 1950s, Drs. Hinkle and Wolf, and they had access to confidential CIA records. They found that the KGB's, the Soviet KGB's, most devastatingly effective torture technique was simply enforced standing. You detain a stand motionless for hours, sometimes days at a time. The fluids flow to the legs, separating lesions form, the kidneys shut down, hallucinations begin. It's incredibly painful. So when you look at those photos from Abu Ghraib of people being long shackled, short shackled, all right, that's a mass situation, okay, where you don't have enough guards to watch all the detainees and make them stand and prohibit them from moving, so you shackle them and you enforce it that way. So that's stress positions. What they found back in the 1950s was that you can make people do false confessions. You can force people to say what you want them to say with these techniques. So it's very effective in getting people to make the statement you wanted to make, make false statements. But it's not very good at extracting objective, intact information. And we saw that the first year of the use of torture. Colin Powell, former military aide, Lieutenant Lawrence Wilkerson, has charged that Bush and Cheney in particular, used torture to extract false information. If you recall, in the run-up to the invasion of Iraq, March 2003, the Bush White House was desperate and was manipulating intelligence to show that Saddam Hussein was in some way involved in production of weapons of mass destruction, chemical, biological, and nuclear warfare. One of the first al-Qaeda captives that they picked up in Afghanistan, a man named Ibn al-Sheikh al-Libi, was rendered to Egypt, and under waterboarding and other forms of torture, he found that when he started mentioning chemical weapons and chemical training by Saddam Hussein, that they stopped torturing him. And so he made statements about that. When Colin Powell appeared before the UN, he made reference to a detainee, single source, who talked about training by Saddam Hussein training al-Qaeda in weapons of mass destruction. He was referring to Ibn al-Sheikh al-Libi. A year later, the CIA branded Ibn al-Sheikh al-Libi a fabricator and withdrew all of its findings. He was later interviewed, and he said, look, you know, they promised me socks and a bed instead of sleeping on a cold floor, so I pretended to be a major figure in al-Qaeda. Then when I was in Egypt, they tortured me, they put me in a box, they beat me up, and once I started talking about chemical weapons, they stopped beating me up and gave me a snack. So for a sock, a snack, and a wooden box, we got evidence that George Tenet brought before the U.S. Senate, that Colin Powell brought before the United Nations, evidence that was completely false. So in other words, once an intelligence service starts torturing, okay, you can extract false information to make any statement you want to make.
Right.
You're completely corrupting, completely compromising the integrity of your intelligence service, of your intelligence product.
Yes. Ultimate manipulation for political gain.
And we've seen the consequences of that, 4,300 dead.
Yes.
You know, 100,000 plus Iraqi dead, and that whole disastrous intervention in Iraq is one of the great disasters of modern U.S. foreign policy, all based upon the false information extracted from one al-Qaeda captive, all right, at the political behest. Wilkerson charges that Cheney ordered that torture directly.
Al, obviously, we all wonder what needs to be done to hold Bush, Cheney, the others accountable for practices of torture.
At this point, politically, the prosecutions will or will not take place by the special prosecutor. It's going to be very narrow, and it's going to be focused on a few field agents. I think at this point, what we should hope for and we should be fighting for, I think if politics is the art of the practical, not the optimum, but the practical, the best we can hope for is a congressional review, perhaps a Senate inquiry, into interrogation in the Bush years, looking at the question of, first of all, the origins of the policy, the full nature of the policy, and then assessing the excesses, why the excesses occurred, also whether or not it worked, honestly engaging it worked, or what the costs of it were, not only the gains, but the costs. A serious, sober, objective, politically neutral inquiry, apart from the prosecutions that might or might not come from the special prosecutor. I think at this point, that's the best we can do. Because right now, as things stand, all right, the CIA has those techniques, those doctrines exist. U.S. legislation which permits psychological torture is still on the books. Section 2340 of the Federal Code, the Enhanced War Crimes Act of 1997, they permit psychological torture. The Military Commissions Act of 2006 is still on the books. It permits psychological torture. It not only immunizes all interrogators for any abuse that they might have made back to 1997, but it allows any president going forward to issue an executive order creating prisons using these harsh, enhanced techniques that the rest of the world considers torture. President Obama issued an executive order closing the prisons and, for the time being, prohibiting the techniques, but any future president within U.S. law can reverse that policy.
Exactly. And another facet that we find very disturbing is the involvement of physicians and medical professionals in having helped devise some of these techniques. That seems to run counter to their oath.
Well, psychiatrists are generally not involved. They haven't been involved since the 1950s. It's really psychologists. And there is an ongoing controversy, which I'm sure that you've covered on other shows, and which you should be covering in future shows, within the American Psychological Association. And these are not medical practitioners. They don't take the Hippocratic Oath, right? Mm-hmm. And their ethics are much more flexible. And they've been, as an association, they've had a long relationship with the Defense Department and the intelligence community going back to the 1950s. It was psychologists that developed these techniques. It's psychologists that have done the SEER training, the Survival Evasion Resistance Escape Training for the U.S. military, which actually applies torture to U.S. forces to steel them against these techniques. So there's a very long history of an intimate relationship between the American Psychological Association and the U.S. national security establishment dating back to the 1950s. And when the War on Terror started, as an association, they held back their ethical restrictions. Individuals, military psychologists, were heavily involved at Guantanamo. They were involved with the CIA as contractors, we now know, in developing these techniques and training a current generation of CIA and military interrogators in their use. And there is a huge debate within this association over the ethical standards. It's really just one branch of the medical community,
right?
The psychologists.
Right. We look forward to hopefully some positive news in the next year.
Thank you, Eddie.
Thank you.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
The Employee Free Choice Act is a proposed bill that would speed up the process for employees to form a union. Under current labor law, workers can select union representation either through an election or through something called card check, a majority sign-up. Here's the catch. Companies can refuse to bargain with a union chosen by a card check process, even if 100% of its employees want the union. Right now, the choice to use an election process or majority sign-up is controlled by the companies. The Employee Free Choice Act, or EFCA, would change this process and remove employers' ability to decide whether to use only the card check process or secret ballot election. This again would make it a much quicker process for employees to form a union. This labor reform law has not been proposed, however, without a fight. Nearly $200 million has been spent to fund a misinformation campaign, backed by such groups as the Chamber of Commerce. Abby Scheer, editorial director of The Public Eye, joins us today to talk more about the current labor situation in the United States and the proposed bill EFCA. Abby, welcome back to Law and Disorder. Abby, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Heidi.
Abby, I was surprised to learn that in this country we have not really seen a major labor reform since 1947 with the Taft-Hartley Act. But you're here today to tell us about something that holds a lot of promise against enormous odds.
Yes, there's the AFL-CIO, SEIU, the Change to Win Coalition, all the labor movement is working to get the Employee Free Choice Act passed this fall. Nobody knows exactly when it would come up. The health reform is taking a lot of attention. But what it would do is it would make it easier to organize a union. And the last major labor law reform, as you said, was in 1947 with the Taft-Hartley Act, which made it harder to organize a union. That's when they banned sit-down strikes. So unions have been laboring under that difficulty of organizing unions, so that now in the 50s, unions represented a third of the labor force. Now they represent about 12%. And that has a lot of ramifications for our democracy.
Let's just go back a step. Part of the difficulty in labor organizing involves the so-called card check process.
Well, the problem in labor organizing is that employers just have so much time to beat back the union. They'll delay and delay and delay. Under the 1930s law, National Labor Relations Act, there's a government-supervised election. But in 40% of the cases, those elections never occur. The corporations just stonewall the union organizing so that until it just fades, they fire people in a third of the organizing campaigns. Companies illegally fire workers, union activists, to intimidate. They call people into closed meetings to give them all of these threats, and they wear them down. But the government sector is much more unionized because they have something called card check. Workers can just sign cards and say that they want to be in a union, and if more than half of the workers, a majority, sign cards, then they have a union. And in some successful organizing campaigns outside of that sector, unions have gotten employers to say, okay, we accept the cards that were signed, but that's very difficult. Few companies will do that. And so what this new law would do would allow workers to decide if they wanted to organize by signing cards or if they wanted to have a supervised election by the government. What's happened is that the business lobby and the right-wing groups like the National Right to Work Committee that have been going after labor for decades, what they've done is they've gotten people on the defensive. So that card check is now being negotiated away out of the bill. Arlen Specter, in particular, he stepped back. He had supported the Employee Free Choice Act in previous years. And he said, well, card check is undemocratic because it takes away the secret ballot, which is exactly the language that was used by the right in trying to get people on the defensive.
When we talk about perhaps the largest opponent of this legislation, we're talking about the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. Apparently, with their deep pockets, they're able to put nearly $500,000 a day into lobbying efforts.
Yeah, during the Center for Responsive Politics found that during the 2007-2008 legislative session that it came out to $400,000 a day. Let's see. It was for a total of $144 million, and that's just for one legislative session. And all business groups, lobby groups, spent $215 million. So you can see the scale of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. And a lot of people think the U.S. Chamber of Commerce is this warm, fuzzy organization, Main Street, businesses, and that is true. That is one element of it. But the U.S. Chamber of Commerce has been on the reactionary side of every struggle that you can think of, from healthcare to labor. They're the largest lobby group in the country.
Now, describe some of their tactics. Are they using the mainstream media to get their campaign out?
Oh, sure. They have an advertising campaign. If you're not in a state represented by a senator who they're targeting, you won't actually hear. I brought an ad with me from Virginia. And you can hear that the rhetoric that this is, it takes away the secret ballot, it's un-American, it's against elections, and unionists are thugs. And it's a very harsh rhetoric that you wouldn't expect from what you consider a mainstream group.
And why would they say unionists are thugs?
Unionists are thugs who will coerce workers to give up their individual rights and make them join a union. And that you can't really trust them with card check because they'll be, you know, the unionists will come to people's door and intimidate them with threats of violence. And of course, the violence that tends to happen comes from businesses. Kim Phillips Fine is a historian at NYU who's looked at how the National Right to Work Committee, since its formation in the 50s, has been able to flip the script. Because before, the corporation's repression of workers was what got all the attention. And what the National Right to Work Committee has done through their propaganda campaigns or misinformation campaigns is to make unions the problem. You asked how the Chamber of Commerce is opposing the Employee Free Choice Act. And one of the ways that they're doing it is with the alliance of banks and the rest of the business community. And Glenn Spencer of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce was part of a call that Citigroup sponsored for the business community to give them a briefing about the Employee Free Choice Act. Citigroup got $50 billion in bailout funds. They got government money to survive, and yet they hosted a private call in March with Glenn Spencer leading the charge about how the Employee Free Choice Act will hurt the business community, destroy jobs, and giving this kind of apocalyptic sense of what was going to happen if the Employee Free Choice Act passed. And then Bank of America had done a call. This came out in January, but the call was done, sponsored in October. Bernie Marcus, the founder of Home Depot, was on that call along with Rick Berman, who's a PR guy from D.C., who's the kind of guy you hire, the tobacco industry hires to make cigarettes seem safe. He has a front group called the Center for Union Facts. So Rick Berman and Bernie Marcus were on this call to talk about how the Employee Free Choice Act would destroy capitalism, destroy business world as we know it, and tried to motivate people on the call to give donations to Republican candidates. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce and their allies were fighting this battle in the last election because they knew if the Democrats got their 60 votes to override a filibuster that the Republicans could use to stop a legislation, that this would have a good chance of passing. Oh, and there's another technique that the U.S. Chamber of Commerce uses. They have a front group of their own called the Alliance to Save Main Street Jobs. So the use of front groups in order to sanitize
their connection.
Yeah, that this isn't about, you know, big multinational businesses. This is about Main Street businesses. So the Alliance for Main Street Jobs, ironically enough, is a business alliance with other large business groups. They retained this woman to do a study about how Employee Free Choice Act would destroy 600,000 jobs. This woman's specialty was intellectual property. This was not her background. She's a gun for hire. This is what she does. You create reports for businesses in order to use in PR campaigns. It was easily debunked, but you still hear people citing that study.
Now, Abby, who is coming out to debunk this study? What's happening on the other side?
This is what's so disconcerting. I'm also involved in reporting on reproductive justice issues. And on both labor and reproductive justice issues, it's very hard to get broad attention. So if you're within the labor movement, everybody knows this stuff. This is not new news, but it's very hard to get beyond those insider information networks. So it is being reported. And as I say, the Center for Responsive Politics, they're coming up with information when the Employee Free Choice Act was was submitted by Tom Harkin in March, they came up with a study in order to show the disparity between what the business lobby spends and what unions spend, because there is this whole rhetoric about unions' disproportionate influence.
Abby, you mentioned earlier on that it's pretty normal for businesses to stall different kinds of union organizing. What is at risk for corporations right now if this were to pass?
Well, there's one worker, Angel Warner, who makes the connection very closely to her own union struggle. She's a warehouse worker from California. They finally organized a union against Rite Aid. They organized Rite Aid, even though Rite Aid fired some of her coworkers. They finally got a union, and now it's been a year and a half, and Rite Aid won't negotiate a contract with them. So what's the point of having a union if you can't get a contract? And another piece of the Employee Free Choice Act would have the union and employer go into arbitration after 90 days if they don't negotiate a contract, only for their first contract. This doesn't count. This wouldn't be in place for any future contracts. This is one of the important moments where employers beat unions. So even if after all of the struggle, you know, all these workers illegally fired, you finally get a union, well, then you don't get a contract. And this legislation would change that. And even in the backtracked version, I heard one worker, a seaman, say at a rally, this is the most important provision, even more important than Karchek, is to get that first contract. So Arlen Specter and Tom Harkin are in a back room trying to figure out how they're going to get a legislation that'll pass and what happens to this provision. I don't know. I don't know what they're going to do about it.
To put this in the broader context, what is the state of unions in this country right now?
Well, unions, surprisingly enough, unions are growing. In the past year, they reversed a trend where they had been losing membership steadily since the 50s. And New York City is interesting because New York has long bucked that trend and had union growth. And I haven't quite figured out exactly how unions have managed this. This is a future story of mine that I'd like to look into. But they've been very aggressive about organizing. And you can see in the healthcare battle just how important unions are for progressive reform. They are the largest base of support for progressive policies. And if unions are as weak as they are now, with only 12% of the labor force, they can't back what we want to happen with a Democratic Congress. So some people say, wow, they should have done labor law reform before they did healthcare, because you need that constituency, you need that base. And the Republicans, of course, will do anything they can to stop it, because white men in unions voted for Obama by 18 points. And white men in general voted for McCain by 16 points. So there's a huge gap, because when you're in a union, you have a sense of being part of a collectivity. It's a challenge to kind of a crude individualism. And you have a sense of building your economic security together with other people and not this individualistic free market ideology. So it's a really important education medium for Americans, for them to have a clear-eyed view of how the world really works. A lot is at stake, then this is why the Republicans are going to do anything to stop this. And I want to say that in the misinformation campaigns, one of the most effective parts of it is the Chamber of Commerce claiming that they're acting on behalf of small businesses, because everybody loves small businesses. And the U.S. Chamber of Commerce has created this alliance between multinationals and small businesses so that you feel like if you want to save your neighbor, you have to oppose unions. That's what they're saying. And
can you describe one and introduce? I believe we have a clip.
Oh, yes. I brought clips from the Chamber of Commerce ad in Virginia, and they're focusing them in states where there are Democrats who they think they can peel away from the pro-labor coalition. And you'll hear unions are thugs. This legislation is anti-democratic. It's a challenge to small businesses. Small businesses will fail. So it's a very apocalyptic vision that they provide in this advertisement.
Let's have a listen.
We can't let Congress do this to Virginia.
Congress wants to strip away the secret ballot.
The private vote is so important to our basic fundamental rights.
And let bureaucrats dictate to Virginia businesses.
A bureaucrat from Washington could never tell any private enterprise how to run their business.
This is going to devastate medium-sized and small businesses.
Tell Congress, protect Virginia from card check. Paid for by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce.
Congress can't compromise on the rights of workers in Virginia.
This isn't true.
Oh, no. No, not at all. And small businesses are actually mobilizing on behalf of the Employee Free Choice Act. The American Rights at Work has been organizing small businesses to step up and say, this does not, unions don't hurt us. And expanding the power to build unions is good for us because it builds people's buying power, because people in unions have more money, and that's good for the economy because it builds buying power. And so there's a whole network of small businesses that are trying to counter the Chamber of Commerce claim that it's
anti-capitalist.
Yeah. I interviewed Rick Wolf, who I know has been on the show, and he said, well, economic history shows clearly that the biggest threat to small businesses is big business. That's what kills small businesses. Unions are not the threat. And the United States has managed, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce has managed this alliance that's been so durable. But that in other countries, he says, this is not the case. He says in France, the small business actually is sort of a swing vote. And there isn't this kind of lockstep with big business. So it's something that we kind of take for granted in our American business ideology that small and big business are kind of the same. And this is one of the successes of the Chamber of Commerce's misinformation campaign broadly over the decades. The small business and medium-sized business sector is shrinking. It's not healthy, but you're right. It's because of the big business taking over their arenas.
I'm sure our listeners are going to be riled up about this. Where can we direct them if they want to get involved?
The full report that I did, they can find that on the Making Contact site, which is www.radioproject.org. And I encourage everybody who's interested in these types of issues to subscribe to the AFL-CIO blog. It gives you all this information and news briefing. I will say that if you're not a part of a union family, it's too bad because you're unplugged from a lot of information. I got a robocall from the AFL-CIO the other day to go to one of the healthcare town halls because my husband is in the UAW. And it's a shame. There's the AFL started its own lobby, its own citizens lobby that you can join if you want to get updates. It's like a move on for labor folks, and you can find that at the AFL-CIO.
And Abby, Public Eye.
Oh, right. My own publication, quarterly, The Public Eye, that comes out of Political Research Associates, which is a progressive think tank that tracks the right wing. You'll find on our website not only my written work on this, but Chip Relay has done research about the business's anti-union campaigns back to the 30s. So they'll find a lot of historical information.
This is fascinating material, Abby. We're so glad that you're on top of it. We look forward to staying in touch with you about updates on this because it's important legislation. It would be landmark legislation if passed.
Thanks so much.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Together, baby. And we got to live together, baby. I am no better. or you. Makes no difference whatever we do. You love me, you know me, you hate me, and then you can't figure out the bad I'm in. Don't like the short hair. Who's trying to be a rich woman that will not help a poor one. Different strokes for different folks. So on and so on. We have a lot of doing it, doing it, doing it. Accept the red one that won't accept the black one that won't accept the white one. Different strokes for different folks. So on and so on. We're blah doing it, doing it, doing it. I'm an everyday person looking for everyday people, na 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 na. I'm an everyday person looking for everyday people, na 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 na. I'm an everyday person looking for everyday people, na 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 na. I'm an everyday person looking for everyday people, na na na. And we got to live together, baby. And we got to live together. And we got to live together, baby. And we got to live together, baby. Let me tell you again what I am now, baby. Na 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 na. I'm an everyday person looking for everyday people. Na 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 na.